similar to how we determine whether quantum antibody systems are in thermal equilibrium or not. So if you approach a lake and you want to know if it's stationary, you wouldn't check every drop of water and to make sure every single drop isn't moving. That's just one, impractical, but two, also like a very unreasonable standard for thermalization. But what you might do instead is, say, drop a leaf on the surface of the water and see if the leaf moves on average. So you don't expect it to not move at all. There might be some fluctuations, but as long as it's not moving on average, you'd say the lake is stationary. That's actually what we do with quantum antibody systems. If we want to know whether a quantum antibody system has reached thermal equilibrium, we'll look at some local observable in the system, and we don't expect it to not change at all. It'll fluctuate to some degree, but we expect it to not change on average. So that's why there's a lake. So why am I interested in thermalization? Well, it comes from a puzzle that's emerged from non-commuting charge physics. So what are non-commuting charges? Well, across physics, systems exchange quantities, so energy, particles, etc. Usually, you've probably encountered them in an introductory StatMech course, where you have some system interacting with an environment, and it exchanges some quantity Q1 and some other quantity Q2. And so these quantities are called charges if they're conserved globally in the system. Now, an implicit assumption in physics is that charges commute. So this assumption, for example, underlies the derivations of the thermal states form. It also underlies the derivations of all the Onsager coefficients. So it's like the Seebeck effect, the Peltier effect, Fick's law, Fourier's law. It also underlies the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis and others. And why this is important is that, you know, non-commutation, while not a uniquely quantum effect, at least plays an important role in quantum mechanics. And so we have to at least allow for the possibility that charges may not commute. And so we ask, well, what happens if they don't? The most immediate thing is that these derivations break down. And so now we set out to rederive these derivations, and in doing so, we come across new physics. So we come across meaningful physical differences. And so there's a review article that came out in NatRefPhys on the topic of just non-commuting charge physics and reviewing the physical differences that emerge. I'm just going to highlight four that motivate this work. One is a reduction in entropy production rates. So this was done using a collisional model. So they had two systems. They pulled out random subsystems from them, had them interact, and then dropped the subsystems back to their respective greater systems. And they looked at the entropy production for each of these collisions. They derive an analytic expression in which one of the terms is negative and a function of whether the charges commute or not. So there's a reduction in entropy production. Another result is an extra deviation from the thermal state. So I mentioned the leaf should, you know, fluctuate a little bit on average. But if the system has non-commuting charges, the leaf can fluctuate a lot more. Two recent works looked at the entanglement that comes from non-commuting charges, comparing analogous models that differ in whether their charges commute, and find more entanglement. And a result from earlier, before the community of quantum thermodynamics community got interested in non-commuting charges, a group looked at the effect of non-abelian symmetries on many-body localization. So this is, for this extent of this talk, is a type of non-thermal behavior. And they found that non-commuting charges also destabilize MBL. The reason I picked these four results is because the first two suggest non-commuting charges should hinder thermalization in some way. You have less entropy production. You have a larger deviation from the thermal state. There seems to be an impedance to thermalization. However, entanglement accompanies thermalization, and non-commuting charges remove a non-thermal phase. Both of these results suggest non-commuting charges should promote thermalization. So these results and some others have raised what some call a non-commuting charge puzzle. It's become an area of interest in the quantum thermodynamics literature. Now, I think it's fundamentally of interest, but also on a practical level, thermalization is a source of decoherence in quantum systems. So if we can resist thermalization in some way, maybe we can leverage that for some inherent noise production in quantum systems, quantum technologies. Okay. Actually, before I go on, is there anything I can clarify? Any questions people have about non-commuting charges? Okay, if you don't, if they come up later.
And they don't commute, is there an h bar that comes in there?
There is still an h bar, yeah. So you can think of like the total spin of the angular momentum. You can have each component of it be satisfied or conserved. Okay, feel free to ask others as they come up. So there's a puzzle around thermalization, but just let's be very clear with what we mean about thermalization. Because at first, you know, if you've never really thought about this and you say, okay, here's a closed quantum system, and I say, okay, it's going to thermalize. You might think I'm crazy because quantum systems evolve reversibly and unitarily. So what does it mean for a quantum system to thermalize? Well, the answer to that question is contained mostly within the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, or ETH. And so it's a statement regarding a local observable, some state, a Hamiltonian, and corresponding expectation values with that state, and expectation values with the thermal state. So this is the state here you might be familiar with. So if I look at the evolution of this expectation value with time, say the system originally is out of equilibrium, and I watch the system evolve as it thermalizes. If the system does thermalize, it's eventually going to stop changing and reach a steady state up to some fluctuations. And so this is what we mean by thermalization. We mean there is some local observable that on average is not changing. So thermalization is defined with some set of observables. And again, this is, I think, the sense in which this is intuitive is that as experimentalists, or I guess we're not experimentalists, but people who are experimentalists outside of PI, if they want to know whether a system is thermalized, they measure something. So thermalization is defined with some set of things that we measure of the system. And you can also take it to an extreme case. Well, if you measured absolutely everything of a system that's evolving unitarily, then yes, you're not going to see a system looking like it's thermalizing. So thermalization is always defined with respect to some local observables. And either this is, the next statement will either be very surprising or unsurprising, but most quantum many-body systems thermalize. Maybe that's surprising because quantum mechanics is reversible. Maybe that's unsurprising because the second law of thermodynamics, you know, trumps all. But most quantum many-body systems thermalize. So I'm interested in when do these systems not thermalize? For example, this is would be extensions beyond this work, but as a starting point, you know, can I look at all the types of non-thermal behavior and say, okay, what does non-commuting charges do to this, to this, to this, to this? Maybe, I mean, it rules out all forms of non-thermal behavior. Or maybe it promotes the different forms of non-thermal behavior. I'm going to start here with one type of non-thermal behavior. And that's quantum systems that have dynamical symmetries. So a system with a dynamical symmetry, this also goes by spectrum generating algebra in the literature. But I'm going to use dynamical symmetry. It's an operator of this form here, it's A, that has this commutation relationship with the Hamiltonian. So it looks like a ladder operator with the some extra restrictions around its form and that lambda is real and non-zero. Any operator that overlaps with the dynamical symmetry will not thermalize. So a very simple example, you have a chain of spins in an external magnetic field. Okay, so you have this Hamiltonian here. These are the dynamical symmetries for the Hamiltonian. And we can see that any operator that overlaps with them will also not thermalize. So you have an external magnetic field. You expect to have precession of the spins around the z-axis and the xy plane. This is a simple example, but you can create more complicated ones. Yeah?
Does it have to be extensive?
So it doesn't. Dynamical symmetries don't necessarily need to be extensive. The reason we are interested in extensive ones, typically we're talking about thermalization or some kind of physical system, is that we want to be able to measure any point of the system and not really care where we are. Like, I don't want to have to put my leaf in a special spot of the lake to see something different than somewhere else. So that's why we want the operator to act identically on each site. So in like the math and the studies of dynamical symmetries aren't always extensive operators, but in many body system cases, they usually are.
Is that mostly translation invariance?
Yeah, you can think of it as like a translation invariance. Actually, is that sufficient? Yeah, that at least means that. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Is the non-zero statement in a thermodynamic limit? Or?
No. Yeah, very small. It still has to be non-zero. Essentially, the evolution that we get. Yeah, there will still be some non-thermal behavior. This lambda will has a relationship with the essentially like a phases that get picked up by the evolution. I don't want to go there. But yeah, even if it's very small, it will still not thermalize.
Yeah. How does this interplay with the reversibility aspect that you mentioned? Like, why is this the only one that won't?
Oh, these aren't the only ones that won't thermalize. These are just, you can define the ones that won't thermalize. Yeah. But for example, if you were willing to find some large observable on your whole system, for example, that also won't look thermal. Good. Okay, so the motivating question for this work is, what are the effects of non-Kuhnian charges on dynamical symmetries? How do non-Kuhnian charges affect this one type of non-thermal behavior? So the first result is a Noether's-like theorem for dynamical symmetries. So usually Noether's theorem relates symmetries with charges. Here we're relating dynamical symmetries with charges. Dynamical symmetries aren't invariances under some transformation, so they're not symmetries in the traditional sense. So this result isn't contained within Noether's theorem already. The second result is, we use the first one to show that non-Kuhnian charges inherently reduce the number of dynamical symmetries in a system. And the way we show that is, we'll take a system with some charges, introduce commuting ones, find more dynamical symmetries, therefore more observables that are non-thermal. And we go and add non-Kuhnian charges, and we're going to find that we remove the existing dynamical symmetries. Okay, a very brief amount of Lie algebras you need to know. I'll keep this very minimum. So Lie algebra, it's a vector space with a Lie bracket. Lie algebras are important in physics because they describe everything in the standard model. So example SU2 is used to describe angular momentum. Lie algebras have a dimension, so it's the number of generators in a basis, and a rank. That's the most number of those generators that commute with one another. So with SU2, we have three polymatrices, and no more than one of them commutes with any other. In the polymatrices example, that was those three polymatrices form one basis, but there are other bases. Another basis is the Cartan-Weyl basis. It consists of Hermitian operators and root vectors, which again look like ladder operators. So with SU2, I could pick, say, my favorite polymatrix is sigma z. These would be the corresponding root vectors. And I can form another basis for SU2. OK, so this is a high-level overview of the proof, something that fits within a 20-minute talk. So for every pair of dynamical symmetries that a Hamiltonian has, there exists a charge defined in this way. And so in the paper, we prove that this quantity Q beta is conserved, it's Hermitian, and also it's extensive. So from any dynamical symmetries, you can always go to charges. From a very large class of charges, you can then go back to dynamical symmetries. So these are any charges that form a Lie algebra. So again, it's very broad. That's everything in the standard model. Plus any charges that form any Cartan subalgebras of Lie algebras. And in those cases, from the charges, you can always go back to the dynamical symmetries. So to prove that that exists, or sorry, that a Hamiltonian exists such that that's always the case, I'll pick this HG to be a Hamiltonian that conserves all the charges of the Lie algebra. So whether or not we're dealing with a Cartan subalgebra, this Hamiltonian conserves the charges of the full Lie algebra. I'll then perturb it with this additional term that's a sum over the charges in the algebra I'm studying. So here that would be the Cartan subalgebra. So because the dynamical symmetries can be written in a basis of charges, this term will always commute with the dynamical symmetries. So then I can go and see the relationship between the dynamical symmetries and this Hamiltonian. The first term will drop away, and I'm left with the commutator of the charges and the dynamical symmetries, which I can then evaluate. And what I end up getting is a relationship now that, again, looks like a dynamical symmetry. So from the charges, there will always exist a Hamiltonian such that I can reverse the relationship. And so this is the correspondence that we have. This is the know there's like theorem. So just a quick illustration before I apply it. If you look at the Hubbard model, actually, how much time do I have? My timer disappeared on this thing. Sorry. I'm just going to skip the Hubbard model for now. But the Hubbard model has dynamical symmetries, these two pairs of dynamical symmetries. Using our lemma, we can find the charges that are known to be there in the Hubbard model. From the charges, we can use our lemma to find the dynamical symmetries known to be there. So it was just a testing space to show how the lemma and theorem works. In the questions, I'm happy to come back to this, but I really want to get to this result, where we're going to begin with some set of charges. Okay, we need some kind of setup to make this comparison. I need some setting in which I'm going to compare the effect of non-commuting charges on dynamical symmetries. So choose some set of charges to be simple. I'm just going to pick a U1 symmetry. I'm going to look at SZ total, okay? Just the total Z component of the spin. I partition my charges into sets of commuting charges. So there's only one charge, so just one set. I choose one of these sets, easy choice, only one. I then construct the basis. So for my charge, I add the operators I need to get to a Cartan-Weyl basis. These elements I added, I'm now going to say, are potential dynamical symmetries of the system. And then I check whether or not they are. And I just move to the next charge and I repeat. Now for this simple subalgebra of SU2, I had one charge, SZ total, and two dynamical symmetries, these two here. This is the simple example I gave, yeah, in the beginning.
So these things on the right, they are like for the simple example that you skipped.
Yeah, exactly. For the simple example from the very beginning, where you just have one charge, the total SZ.
It's not the Hubbard model.
Not the Hubbard model. No, no. The Hubbard model does one of its charges, does also happen to be SZ, though. Total. Yeah. Thank you, though. So that was if you have one charge of SU2. If you go to the full SU2, we now have three sets of charges we partition. Choose any one of them. Let's just choose SZ total again. We complete the basis, add the dynamical symmetries. So we add two dynamical symmetries. And now we're going to repeat and check for the other charges. But if note what happens, if we now go and add SX total, we want the Hamiltonian to conserve SX total. If you look at the form of the dynamical symmetries, if it conserves SX total and SY total and SZ total, it's actually going to also conserve what we used to call dynamical symmetries. So now, by introducing new charges, what were previously dynamical symmetries are no longer dynamical symmetries. They no longer have the defining relation. So by adding two commuting charges, we removed two dynamical symmetries. And the reason we had to do this is both the charges and the one charge in dynamical symmetries formed bases for the algebra. So we can't conserve all the elements when the basis is written one way, and then only conserve some of them if we write the basis in a different way. SU3, we get a very similar story. We start with our charges. These are sums over Raoumann matrices. And so I'll pick two of them. I pick some commuting subset, because I only want to have commuting charges at first. I pick these two. I can then go and identify six dynamical symmetries. And I'm done. So two charges, the sums over these operators, plus six dynamical symmetries. If I now go and I try to conserve the full algebra, the full SU2, I'm going to have four sets of charges. I choose a set, three pairs of dynamical symmetries again. But by the same argument, if I want to conserve, say, tau 1 and tau 2, if I'm going to conserve both of these, I'm forced to also conserve their sum. So A plus or minus 1 is no longer a dynamical symmetry. So I go from two charges, six dynamical symmetries, to eight charges, no dynamical symmetries. So I just want to recap all the cases I showed. So there was the case where we had one subalgebra of SU2. It was an abelian case. We have charges and dynamical symmetries. The Hubbard model, which I glossed over for time, has two subalgebras of SU2. Again, they're abelian, dynamical symmetries. We moved to the non-abelian case, we lost our dynamical symmetries. SU3, we saw the same thing. Charges and dynamical symmetries, go to the non-abelian case, we lose our dynamical symmetries. So why does this always happen? Again, it's because the Cartan-Weyl basis and a basis of charges are each bases for the algebra. So you can't conserve all of one, all the elements of one basis without conserving all the elements when the basis is written differently. So our result is that there is one class of non-thermal dynamics, non-thermal dynamics that get ruled out from non-commuting charges. So non-commuting charges fundamentally oppose a certain type of non-thermalizing quantum dynamics. Okay, where do we go from here? We saw one type of dynamics that were removed. There's some others to look at. So this many-body localized phase was argued to become destable with non-abelian symmetries. Looking for opportunities now to make that more rigorous. Can we say that MBL is fundamentally opposed by non-commuting charges? That's one area to look. Another is work around quantum scars. So quantum scars are particular, they're particular initial states where if you look at their entanglement, you would expect them to thermalize, but they don't. The reason I mentioned them is because there's a work where they identify Hamiltonians for building quantum scar systems. And while they don't use this language, what their procedure ends up being is you create a system with non-commuting charges, and then you break the non-abelian symmetry. And then you get a quantum scar. And if you add back the non-abelian symmetry, you lose the quantum scar. So there also seems to be an opposition with non-commuting charges and non-thermal dynamics here. And the last one would be, you know, we looked at some ways of breaking non-abelian symmetries. And in this way that I looked at, you introduce a dynamical symmetry. But there exist other ways to break non-abelian symmetries without introducing dynamical symmetries. So for example, with this Hamiltonian, if I turn on this coupling, I would break the symmetry, but there's no dynamical symmetry. What happens there? Okay, so I want to thank for listening. These are people I've worked with recently with non-commuting charges. This is the paper I talked about today. I mentioned the review article that's given here. I mentioned two earlier works on entanglement dynamics, so you could see these two for that. And a lot of this work has been around studying non-commuting charges in quantum many-body systems. The work that made that bridge between kind of the abstract Lie algebra theory of non-commuting charges and connected it to Hamiltonians was done in this work. So yeah, thanks for listening, and hopefully I have time for questions. Yeah, I do? Okay, good. Yes, please.
I have a question in the case of Heidegger and Arkham. So there is a dynamical symmetry, namely a tensor vector. Suppose in the case of, when you solve Schrodinger equation of a vector and Coulomb potential, they call it a dynamical symmetry.
Okay.
So the tensor vector which talks about the generality of the various levels.
Uh-huh.
I just want to point it out.
I see. Thank you. Yeah, it might actually be the same use of the term dynamical symmetry. Because even with a single atom, the spin is up, and then there's some precession around that, the z-axis.
If you modify the Coulomb potential, it breaks. Then you have to use the Coulomb potential.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess there's a similar phenomenon you could have where if you have many of these hydrogen atoms and some coupling between them, where they preserves a symmetry of some kind, and then you add this external field, and you would break the symmetry, and it would depend on the Coulomb potential in that case. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks. I'm around for other questions.